Blog Talk Radio.
Take a licking. There is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call for Super Chicken.
Welcome to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by ManaPro, providing the best quality products that your animals deserve at a value you can appreciate. ManaPro, nurturing life. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer. My co-host is poultry advocate and author of City Chicks, Chicken Tractor, and other great titles, Pat Foreman. Today is Thursday, May 26th, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show that is broadcast around the world. This radio show is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. You can follow the Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer radio show 24 hours a day at our website, chickenwhisperer.com. That's chickenwhisperer.com. If you're listening live today on Blog Talk Radio, I invite you to join us in the live chicken chat room that's going on right now. You can talk with other Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer fans and other chicken owners from around the country. You can also ask any questions you may have for our special guest when we have them on. All you have to do is click on the Chat Now button at our homepage there at Blog Talk Radio. Take a moment to register. That'll get you your own unique, fun, and creative screen name. Then you can come on in and sit a spell, have a great time, meet some new friends, and talk all about our passion and hobby of backyard poultry, show poultry, preparedness, sustainable living, urban farming, urban gardening, and anything else that just might tickle your fancy. I would also like to invite you to mark this radio show as a favorite and request to be on our friends list while you're there at Blog Talk Radio. We hope you'll take a moment to do this again today. And again, I would like to thank you all for tuning in to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by ManaPro.
ManaPro is committed to providing the best quality products that your animals deserve at a value you can appreciate. No matter the animal, no matter the product, you can be certain that ManaPro cares as much about the well-being of your flock as you do. So try one of the many poultry products offered at a retailer near you. ManaPro, nurturing life.
Designed for starting and growing game birds, turkeys, ducks, geese, and broilers, ManaPro's Game Bird Showbird Crumbles feature 24% protein and a combination of vitamins, minerals, and yeast culture. This complete feed does it all, from growth and weight gain to healthy development and even improved digestion. So next time you're starting some new birds, try ManaPro's Game Bird Showbird formula and see the difference.
Mount Healthy Hatcheries has been a hatching tradition for over 80 years. Home of the healthiest chicks, Mount Healthy Hatcheries offers a wide selection of bantams, turkeys, guineas, ducks, pheasants, and of course, meat birds and layers. Order online at mounthealthy.com. That's mthealthy.com. Or give them a call at 1-800-451-5603. Don't forget to ask about their free bonus chicks offer. Mount Healthy Hatcheries, home of the healthiest chicks.
Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, hens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's WAREMFGINC.com or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing. Critter-Cages.com is your one-stop shop for all your critters' housing needs. They stock a wide selection of supplies and equipment for rabbits, guinea pigs, hamsters, mice, rats, ferrets, chinchillas, chickens, and other small critters. Their chicken selection includes chicken barns, chicken coops, and chicken yards from top manufacturers. Your critters will love their selection of quality products, and you'll love their low prices. Visit them online at critter-cages.com. That's critter-cages.com.
If you're looking for a unique gift idea for that dog, cat, horse, or chicken lover, then look no further than HobbyHillFarm.com. They have a wide selection of gifts for both the home and farm. My favorite is the chicken noodle soup with noodles shaped like chickens. I'm sure you'll find everything you're looking for at HobbyHillFarm.com. That's HobbyHillFarm.com.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
All righty. Thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. It is Thursday, and we've got a great guest today. Got a great topic today. I'm really interested. I've got my Chicken Whisperer notebook out. But before, folks, before we can go one step further, you know, there's just, sometimes you feel that void and something is missing and it just cannot be complete, you know, and you just can't go any further without something happening or somebody joining us. And today that just happens to be the one and the only author, poultry advocate, all around multi-talented young lady, Pat Foreman. Hey, Pat.
You are frisky today, aren't you? That's wonderful.
Me.
Oh gosh, yeah, boy, yeah. I've got to warn you. I'm driving along I-81 to Harrisonburg, and I need to sign off about 1 o'clock ish. Okay. So just for, and I already told Richard Frudenberger that, so he's all set for whatever. So, but it is so hot here. I am so glad that we had Peter Brown on yesterday talking about how to handle your coop in the heat. That was absolutely timely. It's 85 degrees right now. My God, summer just instantly popped out. I'm sweating, and I'm in the air conditioning. How's it down there in Georgia? You guys must be sweltering too, eh?
It's been pretty warm. Yes, it has. And, wow, I mean, yesterday I think I posted on my personal Facebook page, our local, and we're very fortunate, one of our local stations here at WSB TV, and they have the main talk radio station here. They have what they are saying is the most advanced radar technology in the world. They just spent, I don't know how many millions of dollars on it, way more sophisticated than just Doppler. And so it's amazing. So we're very fortunate. Whenever, whether I'm at the farmhouse or here, wherever I'm at, I can go to their website. They have something called interactive radar. And one reason why they say their radar is so advanced is that even Doppler, by the time they get it in the station, apparently could be 5 or 6 minutes delayed versus, you know, live. This thing is just, anyway, it's amazing. So I go to their website, and I may not be looking at that particular radar, but I really like the features of it, and I can look all over the country. And then you can click on a button, and it will show what's going on in each cell. And yesterday, at a particular time, I don't know, yesterday even, I think it was, I counted on that particular radar six different tornadoes that were on the ground at the same time across America.
Oh, my God.
It was amazing. Now, I say that, it comes up with different symbols for heavy rain, light rain, hail. If you click on that particular symbol, it'll show you what prediction of hail it is, golf ball size, pea size, dime size. And actually, one of the definitions of the hail, one of the descriptions of the hail on that website is hen egg. I thought that was kind of neat. Hen egg size hail. Yeah, so I thought, hey. So it was truly amazing. And you can, you know, winds, and it shows the direction of that storm cell going, and then it puts up a little triangle if there's possible tornadic activity, or you would say a storm capable or tornadic activity has been detected, and then it pops up that little red tornado-looking thing. And there were six at one time on apparently. It was just truly amazing. So we are definitely going through some crazy times here with our weather. And it has been hot here. It's been, 90, 92, 93.
Oh, my.
Our car down at the farm last week said 96. I'm not sure that was totally accurate, but it's dropped down a little bit. We should be getting some storms here later this evening, but they're saying slight risk of anything severe. We're in the slight risk range, so just keep my fingers crossed. I'm not a big fan of storms at all. That's why we're getting a storm shelter, but down there at the farmhouse. But so, yeah, it's been crazy, and I know we have a lot of listeners. I think about when I saw a couple of what they claimed possible tornadoes on the ground near Dallas. I thought about our friend in the chat room, East Dallas Dave. You know, when it goes up through Michigan, I think about, you know, our
friend.
It's just, I think about all these folks that I know, and I don't know exactly where they live in each state, but it's interesting now that, you know, we have the worldwide audience, and I'm starting to pick up where people kind of, what states they live in anyway. And I think, oh, I hope she's or he is taking care of themselves. I hope they're taking cover if they're in that area and things like that. But the bad part is that I don't want the storms, but we desperately need the rain. You know, it's funny, people who listen a long time thinking, okay, I'm tired of rain now. This is the 19th day of rain, and this is kind of crazy. And then now it's like we've been probably, I would say, close maybe to 2 months without any significant amount of rain here. And then and the crops in South Georgia, the crops are totally, at least a month down at the farmhouse where we have had nothing but maybe on an occasional day just a trace, maybe not even a measurable amount. So the fields down there are so dusty, the crops are really feeling the heat because it's been at least 30 days, and I may be saying close to 45 to 60 days without any significant or traceable amounts of rain down there. It's horrible. So, yeah, somebody in the chat room is like, it always works that way. Well, you can have all the rain we're getting right now. And, you know, you got the Mississippi flooding from all the rain. And then here we are having kind of a little drought in South Georgia with our crops. So it's concerning when we already know that food prices are up 6%, 7%, 8%. That's just what they're telling us. You've got the USDA saying that they suspect that when they get a grip of how much corn that the farmers are going to have in the ground this year, it may only produce 5% of all the corn we used last year as a nation. And talking about the prices in July going up again for corn and wheat, it's a little nerve-wracking. So, but you know, now we have this rain issue, I mean, the lack of rain here in the South. So, you know, who knows? But yes, that was a great show yesterday with Peter Brown, the chicken doctor. And he, again, firststatevetsupply.com is his site, and he's got that consultation program. And
that's wonderful.
If we have issues, $25, I mean, you can't beat it. And could probably save, not just thinking about, oh, $25 to save my one chicken. No, what the advice he gives you could save your entire flock. And you think
that's
about
right.
The amount that you have in your chickens with just even Chick Starter, if you got them from Chicks, let alone you pay $2 for them, factor in the feed, factor in the time, the waterers, the chicken coop, and all of that. Factor in, it's not just a $2 or $3 chicken. And then we're not talking about hundreds or hundreds of dollars. We're talking about $25 for about, again, maybe the most accurate, you know, and I don't like to use the word diagnoses, but the most accurate help you can get without, again, maybe taking your chicken to a certified avian veterinarian, doing lab work, paying that, you know, $100, $200, $300, $400. And where he can help you right over the phone. So $25, I mean, come on, folks, you can't beat that. And then all this information, I'm telling you, I love the forums. I love my Facebook page. I love, there's a lot of great chicken websites out there. There's a lot of experienced folks But at the same time, I see an awful lot of bad information out there. That's why I don't, you know, I try to answer as many questions that I feel I'm capable to answer on Facebook page. If not, I refer them over to either Bridget McCray, PhD poultry scientist, or our good friend Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor. These are folks with degrees in poultry science, all the way up to the PhD level. And so, you know, I try not to, you know, I can say, well, in our experience, this is what we did. This is what I'm familiar with. And other people can do that. But I've seen an awful lot of bad and poor information that's given out there that may or may not take your chicken or your flock's life. So you just have to be very careful with that. And I know money's tight for everybody, but $25, I mean, we have a responsibility to take care of our animals. When our goat got a distended abdomen, when she was just, you know, what, 2 weeks old, we were still bottle feeding her, 3 weeks old, you know, at 2 a.m., you know, or maybe it was about 11:30 p.m. I went out to check on them, and here's her gut all, you know, I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be expensive, you know. I got to go to a 24-hour vet now. I had never happened to have this happen this to a goat before. We've had goats for years, and so loaded it up in the car, took it to a vet, to it. I mean, you know, it was a chunk of change. But again, I felt like, okay, if this goat dies because I didn't go get it help, I'm going to feel bad because I have a responsibility to take care of my animals. Mm-hmm. But again, at the same time, as much as I love my dog, if they come back and say, you know, I can take this cancerous tumor out, it's going to be $1,500. You know, I think everybody has that that limit, whether it be 100, 125, 1500, whatever the case may be. But I know we should have, you know, do what we can. So, hey, $25 and you're getting some good, valuable information that could save your whole flock. Factor that into a couple of bags of feed and you've saved your money. So, especially feed pot.
Well, plus Whisper, he will waive the fee if you buy something from him.
That you
all
need.
You have to do
that,
is
that
take his advice and buy it. By the cure, by the remedy.
That you probably already need anyway. That is absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And some people are feeding organic feed at literally $25 to $30 a bag. So one bag of feed, you may have just cured your entire flock with whatever it may have been. So you just have to think about that. Great resource. Yeah, so perfect. Let's see. I've got it disappeared. Doggone it. I had to reboot my chat room. It was messing up. I couldn't scroll down. But I got a, let's see, I think it was from, let me see who it was from here. Let me scroll down and see if they're in the chat room. Yeah, Nightwalker1 in the chat room sent me over an instant message that said he hadn't seen it in the press release yet, but a town, and I believe it was Wisconsin on Monday, in a vote 6-1, made chickens legal there. And so to that small town up there in Wisconsin on Monday, 6-1, in favor of keeping backyard poultry. I hope that the law they passed is really allows you to have chickens. Let me put it that way. The viral video we did, well, the video that has become viral, 33,000 views now, that we did with Luke Ludkowski. And the chicken underground or the chicken conspiracy folks, you know, where I'm blacked out of the, you know, black lit and all that kind of stuff, can't really see me. And then my buddy who's got the mask on, you know, playing the issue. And somebody had mentioned, I noticed on one of the comments that, you know, I love one of the comments the Chicken Whisperer made about cities saying and legally being able to say, oh, we welcome chickens here. We're chicken friendly. We do. You can have chickens in the city. You just have to abide by the ordinance that are there to protect, you know, other residences from, you know. And then you look at the law, and the law was purposely written so strict, knowing that it eliminates probably 90 to maybe even 100% of the people in their town from allowing backyard chickens. Like, oh, the chicken house can't be more than or can't be 200 feet away from property
line.
And so,
even 100 feet, it knocks out probably half of most city dwellers.
So they'll write it like that, knowing that it's, so we can now, if we do this, we can say, oh, we allow chickens, but they write it knowing that they really eliminate everybody. So we're on to them when they do that. It's not, I mean, what do these people think, that we fell off the turnip truck yesterday? Yeah, I may have been born at night, but it wasn't last night, folks. So, I mean, come on. Just craziness.
fallen off the turnip truck?
Yeah, I may have just fallen off the turnip truck, but
where did that come from?
It's an old saying my dad used to say. He says, I may have just fallen off the turnip truck, but it wasn't, I didn't just fall off the turnip truck.
Love it.
So yeah, so yeah, that's just an old, I guess, I don't know, it may be worldwide, but I just know it as a Southern saying where I would say, I didn't just fall off the turnip truck, and I may have been born at night, but it wasn't last night. So, you're not pulling anything over our people. So, very cool. Okay, let me see. I got a question here. I put an electric fence around my garden. My uncle thinks they will sense the electric fence and avoid it. I just want to know it won't seriously hurt them, meaning their chickens. So, and my understanding, I've never had an electric fence, and we have considered looking at them. In fact, when we go to a lot of these trade shows, I talk to the companies that manufacture them to see, to learn about them, to see if it may be an option for us. From what I've seen, you can adjust the potency, if you will, the charge of the fence. But I know a lot of people that use electric fence around their chicken coops, around their chicken runs, with success. And they don't walk outside every day and have fried chickens laying in the run because they're using an electric fence. So I'm going to turn this kind of over to you, Pat, and to see if you know somebody firsthand that's using an electric fence and the deal with the chickens kind of reaching through the fence to grab grass and then getting a little pop of that fence. What say you on this subject?
Well, when we had the free range turkey and chicken farm, we used the electric fence extensively, not to keep the chickens out of something, but more to keep the predators from getting at the chickens.
Right.
And we never lost a single animal, chicken or even goat or turkey to the electric fence. If they're just using it around their garden, and if it's just to keep the chickens contained, chickens are pretty easy, I think, when it comes to keeping them in. Even a 3 to 4 foot fence, if they're not, really flying chickens, meaning some chickens are a little more flighty than others. But as long as they've got some free range and green stuff to eat in their run or wherever, they put very little pressure on a fence to try to get through it. So I suggest more as a perimeter fence because it's kind of expensive, and then just use a chicken wire or a 2x4 welded wire fencing with the posts. You can just pound them in the metal or wooden, and that pretty well will contain them outside a garden. It's now if you're talking about deer, or that's another story, of course. But they you'll need an 8-foot fence to keep deer out of some gardens.
Yeah, exactly. But, at least.
Yeah. But that said, the electric fence is wonderful. Yeah. We used solar chargers on ours,
right.
We could adjust the charge to it. One of the problems is you got to keep the grass from shorting it out. So you got to keep the grass pretty short under and around the fence, and of course get your grounding rod in there nice and deep. But I love electric fences. They work. They sure train me. I can even know that it's off, and I won't want to touch it.
Yeah, exactly. No, good. Yeah, I think this young lady was talking about keeping the predators away from them, and if the chicken happens to be reaching through that fence or something to get grass, as a lot of them do, and then get popped by that wire. So thank you for that.
Well, their feathers insulate them. Well, in fact, they can learn to duck underneath if there's a little dip in the ground, and they'll get shocked, but they don't feel it because their feathers. They would feel it on their face, but they learn pretty fast. Chickens aren't as dumb as people think they are. learn pretty
true.
Fast to keep their face away from the spark, so to speak. So, yeah. But poultry netting it does work. It is, of course, it doesn't work for the raptors or the airborne predators, but it does certainly works for the ground predators. Right. And what's interesting with foxes is they'll come up and what they like to do before they jump is they'll put their paws up to see how high it is. I've seen them do that, and then they'll kind of gauge it. Of course, they get a shock first off on those little paws or on a wet nose. They're pretty suspicious of it from then on out. And it becomes a psychological barrier then at that point, so, or can. Just another little vignette, probably more than you wanted to know.
No problem.
We had a terrible fox problem when we had the farm, and like your fences really helped us control that.
My neighbor down south, she's taken it down since, but her husband, before he passed, put up a electric fence around their front yard because they wanted to maintain it pretty nice to keep the armadillo out. The armadillo would get up in their front yard and waller down into the ground and turn over grass and things like that. So they put an electric fence up to keep the armadillo out of her yard. So I know that can be effective. Hey, I just got a nice little comment on my Facebook page from a young lady named Debbie Cooper. I think the Chicken Whisperer is a good thing. It is a good good remembrance of the olden years. I just love it.
Aww.
Glad you have this. So that's pretty good. Thank you very much, Debbie Cooper, for that nice post there. And some other good news. Tomorrow is, guess what, Fun Friday. So
Fun
not only
Friday.
Fun Friday. And not only do Pat and I have a lot of cool prizes to give away, and we're really looking forward to that. And, hey, just call in, answer a trivia question, and that prize is yours. So, hey, Fun Fridays are fun. We're laid back. We've learned about sustainability and urban farming and gardening and preparedness and all that great stuff throughout the week. Friday's a time to sit back, let our hair out, and relax and get ready for the fun weekend on Fun Friday. So, but tomorrow is going to be even more fun and more cool than just our regular Fun Fridays, if you can imagine that. Tomorrow, Pat and I are giving away the grand prize package for our Chicken Coops for Classrooms contest. Chicken Coops for Classrooms. And we were taking nominations up until midnight, I believe, on the 13th of May. And then we will announce tomorrow the winner. We'll try to call the school if they're still open. And we'll answer the phones tomorrow live during the radio show and let them know that they have won this awesome, awesome prize package. I say awesome prize package. I'll go through it here, and then we'll go to break or see if we got some chicken in the news, go to break, and then bring on our good friend Richard Frudenberger. But they're going to get, the school is going to get, and we'll get this to them this fall. So when they come back to school this fall, they'll get everything shipped to them over the summer, and then this fall they'll be able to dive right in to urban chicken keeping there at their facility at their school. So they're going to get a dozen fertile hatching eggs from mypetchicken.com, Derek and Tracy over there. They're going to get a beautiful incubator from brensey.com, really nice top-of-the-line incubator. They're going to receive a brooder kit, so once the chicks hatch, they can go in a little brooder, complete brooder kit from critter-cages.com, the same one that we give away actually on Thursdays. And then they're going to receive a beautiful chicken coop from Ware Manufacturing. Ware Manufacturing, you can find a lot of their products at critter-cages.com. And so they've donated a very beautiful coop for this contest. And then, of course, they're going to get a book from Pat City Chicks. They'll get my book. They'll get Christine Heinrich's book. And so it's a really nice prize package, and we're going to be giving that away to tomorrow. Okay, I got this note. McFarland, Wisconsin, they ended up allowing chickens. So we've on Monday. So congratulations to the folks there in McFarland, Wisconsin. You can now apparently have backyard chickens. Congratulations on all of your hard work and getting that done. I know it's most of the time no easy task. But again, we know if you share the factual information with them and can educate them and they're willing to listen and learn, then in most cases, we feel, Pat and I, about 85% of the cities that do approach changing their laws do change them to allow backyard poultry. Some more strict than others. We just talked about that this morning. But we think most of them are trying to do the right thing once they get educated. So congratulations to the folks there in Wisconsin. So any brief chickens in the news with us today, Pat? Chickens in the News is brought to you by MeyerHatchery.com. Our good friends up there in Polk, Ohio. I know that Nick, he's often in the chat room. He visits there quite often. And so you can visit them online at MeyerHatchery.com. Pat, any chickens in the news today? I was looking. It's kind of slow lately. I don't think I have anything.
Yeah, no, I don't. It has been really slow, except, you know, be careful because heat can kill a chicken just about as fast as any predator can. So make sure they have fresh, cool water. And if they do get overheated, you know, take care of them fast because that's I know we've lost chickens to heat stroke and heart attacks from the heat, and it's just terrible. You walk out and they're dead. That's kind of what it is. So
right.
That'd be my news, is really tend your flock and keep it cool. Keep a cool flock. That's my advice.
Good deal.
Yeah. Nope.
All righty. Well, I've got right at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, half past the hour, so we're going to go to a commercial break. And then when
good
we come
morning.
Back, we're going to welcome our good friend Richard Frudenberger. Our topic today, if I'm not mistaken, is I know we're going to be talking about dehydrators, but I think homemade dehydrators
right.
at that. So how cool, instead of going out and spending maybe hundreds of dollars on one, Richard's going to talk about making one out of maybe recycled material or how simple it can be or how complex it can be, depending on, and I'm sure we'll talk about solar while we're doing this, solar dehydrators as well. So get your pen and paper out during the break, folks. We'll be back right after this short break.
When you need an incubator, think Brensea, the incubation specialist. Brensea has been a world-leading manufacturer of incubators for over 30 years. Incubators from 7 to 380 eggs with high-quality electronic and digital controls, including precise humidity control and programmable egg turning, all at surprisingly affordable prices. Visit them online at Brensea.com. Brensea spelled B-R-I-N-S-E-A. That's Brensea.com or call 1-888-667-7009. Enter the coupon code WHISPER at checkout and save 10% on their incubators, brooders, egg handlers, and other incubation accessories. When you need an incubator, think Brensea, technology you can trust.
You have the chickens, the coop, and the run, but do you have the egg cartons? Don't put your beautiful farm fresh eggs in any old used grocery store egg carton. Impress your friends with your very own custom labeled egg cartons from eggcartons.com. They have a large selection of custom egg cartons, stamps, and labels to choose from. Pick out your new custom egg cartons at eggcartons.com. That's eggcartons.com.
Pictures of chickens on aprons are common across America, but picture a chicken wearing an apron and you'll probably get a good chuckle. Laugh if you must, but nothing protects hens better than the Hen Saver Hen Apron. Hen Saver Hen Aprons protect your hens from the damage caused by an overly affectionate rooster and may even provide protection from an unexpected hawk attack. Hen Savers come in several different sizes to fit both bantam and standard-sized hens and roosters. Colors include camo, denim, navy, brown, khaki or black, and soon pink. Crazy K Farm is expanding its already colorful Hen Saver collection to include the color pink. A portion of their sales will be donated to organizations that fund breast cancer research and awareness. Order your Hen Saver aprons today at hensaver.com. That's hensaver.com.
Ideal Poultry has been a family-owned and operated business since 1937. Their business is built on customer service and quality poultry, from rare white and brown egg layers to broilers, ducks, turkeys, and bantams. Ideal Poultry is the largest supplier of backyard poultry in the United States, shipping close to 5 million chicks annually. Visit them online at idealpoultry.com. That's idealpoultry.com. You've ordered your new baby chicks and even have the brooder prepared, but now it's time to order that new chicken coop. My Amish Goods offers quality-built chicken coops for every size, flock, and budget. They have many styles and colors to choose from and will ship them fully assembled right to your front door. Act now and receive a special upgrade at no additional charge. Visit them online at myamishgoods.com. That's myamishgoods.com.
This looks like a job for
Super Chicken.
You get the super sauce, I'll don my super suit.
All righty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. And today, Great show. You get that pen and paper out. We're going to be talking with Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine. You can visit them online, backhomemagazine.com. One of our most popular shows, and if you like what you hear, then of course you can get 10 times more of this information out of their magazine publication. Just visit backhomemagazine.com. All righty, Richard, welcome back to the show. So glad to have you back.
Oh, thank you, Andy. I'm glad to be here. We got a really good topic this week.
Solar
dehydrators, and I was going to talk a little bit about the solar, do-it-yourself solar stuff, and then in general just dehydrating food in general, because that's sort of a, I think there's a lot of misconception in the idea of what dehydrated food actually is. So
yeah,
we probably cover both those things.
Great, and I was going to add that when you're online shopping, because we do a lot of preparedness on this show, when you're online shopping for like the number 10 cans of sealed product, you can choose between the dehydrated or the freeze-dried. There is a little bit of a difference. It doesn't always mean that one's going to last longer than the other, but basically when you're talking about preparing it and whatnot, I'm not going to get into that now, but also for in case you haven't thought about it, for our folks that listen who are in the preparedness mode and are looking at long-term storage, you can dehydrate your own food and then put it in a Mylar bag, seal it with the Mylar sealer, and then put it in a 5-gallon food-grade bucket, and then you're contributing that way to your long-term storage as well by dehydrating it yourself. So that's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So though a lot of us are talking about, you know, or think when we talk about dehydrating, oh yeah, I'll pick some banana chips for my kids for lunch or the apple chips or whatever the case may be, you can also use the same technique, folks, because you're buying it in the number 10 cans from these expensive dealers online. You could don't underestimate that or don't just close that off. You can dehydrate your own food and use it and seal it properly for your long-term storage as well. So wanted to add that in case people weren't thinking down that pathway when we talk about dehydrated food too. Sorry to interrupt. Wanted to get that out there. So let's continue.
good job.
Yeah. No, that's no interruption at all. That's a really good point. And you know, just shopping, you can see how much dried fruit costs or how much dried herbs cost. When you, especially in the grocery store where they're prepackaged and they're in very small quantities, if you figured out how much per pound that would be or how much per ounce that would be compared to a bulk purchase at the co-op or health food store or something, it's phenomenally more expensive at the, you know, at the regular old grocery store. And then even the co-op can be, even though it's reasonable, it can still be expensive. And there's really no reason at all why you can't, especially with herbs, can't be growing this. The herbs right in your garden and then drying them yourself. But I guess one of the first question is, why do we even want to dry them? The answer to that is really just to keep them preserved. You want to keep them preserved with the vitamins and minerals and food value, nutritional value in the herb or the food you're drying. And you want to do it in such a way that all moisture is removed without cooking the food. You're drying it. You're not cooking it. And once all the moisture is removed, there's no danger of mold, mildew, microorganisms remaining in there for festering into the food. Then you can package them up and store them like you said, Andy. So that's the main point. And you know, the number one problem that I think exists out here in the general population as far as newbies or newcomers coming into the world of drying is they want to cook it. And it is not a food cooking process at all. In fact, cooking the food or the herbs is the best way to destroy the nutrition in them. And so the difference between cooking and drying is actually just a matter of temperature. And believe it or not, depending on the source you look at, we have several sources, several books we have at the magazine bookstore that we sell. One is called Dry It, You'll Like It, and that's a lot of recipes. Yeah, it's a great little book. Yeah, it's cheap. I mean, it's like $8 or $8.50, something like that. It's a self-published book. It has been ongoing, running for I really don't know how many years, probably at least 20 years, if not more. Great little book. And then it also has some It has some drawings and some references for making your own food dryer. Even some of them can be made out of cardboard and very inexpensive materials. The other book I was thinking is called The Stoller Food Dryer, and that's a more thorough half of it is about actual detailed building plans about making a fairly large solar food dryer, wooden out of wood and strips of wood and plywood and glass and fasteners and such. That's more of a commitment. That's something you'd probably have to put on wheels. It's a little bit bulky, but if you're making a commitment to drying foods, it's an excellent way to get in cheap. But either of these designs or any other design, I mean, there's some extension, cooperative extension agents around the country, depending on the state university system you're looking at. I'm sure Pennsylvania probably has something. I know we do in North Carolina, and I had looked at one. Purdue Cooperative Extension published a drying foods at home pamphlet that all really good information from knowledgeable folks who you can basically download this from the internet or write for copies or possibly pick them up at your local extension service, or they can order them for you if they don't happen to have them right in stock there. But essentially the difference is food drying takes place at as low as 95 degrees Fahrenheit and really rarely goes up to more than probably about 120, if that, 110, so basically saying between 95 and maybe 100, 110 or 115 degrees is a good drying range depending on what you're drying. And, you know, our cooking is totally different. That really starts at 160 degrees, and then, 160 to 180, that's when your actual cooking process starts to take place.
Will you repeat that temperature zone again for proper dehydration? Sure. You said 95 to
115, I think, would be a safe level.
When you said that, since I'm so focused on it on a daily basis anyway, not that you would want to do this in a used one, but I'm thinking you hatch chickens out in an incubator.
Yeah.
99 degrees. You said that, and I'm like, ding. And I was like, hey, man, I can use my Genesis incubator and put some banana chips in there. And when it's
right. Just don't put the moisture in. You want to keep the moisture down. But
that's
interesting thought, Whisper. Yeah. Why not?
If all you have around and it hits the fan and you're thinking, I want to dehydrate this. No, I'm sure there's all kinds of big, bad, and ugly things that you don't want to do with a used chicken incubator. And dehydrating food is probably one of them. But that when you were going through those temperatures, that's the first thing that entered my mind that I have around the house already was a chicken incubator at that time. But yeah, exactly. So hey, it's the thought process, being the chicken whisperer, I guess.
Well, you're probably okay up to the point of getting rid of the moisture. I mean, that everything, the temperature's right, the size is probably adequate. You would have to have some racks, but the big deal is getting rid of that moisture, because you can if you just close it up and didn't put any venting or a way for air to get in and get out again, it would just drive the moisture right back into the environment. So you don't want to do that. But
sure.
But the temperature is right, and the range in between. So we get 115, say maximum for drying. And then we start our cooking at 160. So the range in between, say between 120 and 150, just as a mid range there, is that's the temperature that you're really not going to. You will dry the food, but you will not yet be cooking it. But you are still deteriorating the nutritional value. So that's a range that it would be adequate. It would be okay if that's all you could get, but ideally what you would want to do is take the time. That's the whole thing, is you're trading temperature for time. It is far more desirable to let it take a whole day or more to dry and do it right and just let the time take its toll than to kick up the temperature, 15, 20 degrees and hope it just speed it up a little bit, because that's going to be what drives the nutrition out of the food. And in some cases, it can make the food too tough for, like some of the fruit leathers and things. You may not want it as tough. But the main idea is to get the food onto racks, get the each rack separated from the rack above and below it, so the air can circulate between the racks and both through the racks, because the racks are screened, and possibly around the racks. I mean, some can come in from the sides. But in commercial dryers, or in not commercial, but in purchase dryers, store bought dryers, they manage all that very well. There's a fan, usually a fan mechanism to force the air, and there's a heating mechanism to keep the temperature at a very closely controlled level, which is adjustable. It does use electricity, and it's not so much that it uses a whole lot, but since we are drying the food for, you know, 8 hours, 10 hours, or more, when you start using the heater and the fan at that length of time, it does consume, you know, not humongous amounts like a refrigerator might, but it does over time consume a little energy. So we've got that's where the solar dryer comes in, and you can really, especially in the climates where you have a good strong, long hours of sunlight during the day. Can really take advantage of that. You know, Northwest is not parts of the Northwest and parts of the Northeast are not always great for reliability of long-term sun. Most of the South and definitely the Southwest would be a much more reliable long-term tendency to have a longer stretch of sunlight. Because what you really don't want to do is to get halfway through the process and then still have it moist and sort of put it away at that point, because it will. The moisture will attack the food, and it's not as easy to pick up. So to pick up from that point and continue. So that's why people who have well designed dryers, they will put light bulbs in there, just a low wattage light bulb. So in the event that they dried 8 hours and the thunderstorm came up, and they really are in no position to sort of stop the drying process, roll it into the garage or in the patio or someplace out of the rain, and plug it in and let the light bulb carry the rest of the way, and that works.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and you know, that way you don't need to use it. You don't need to use the light bulb unless you really have to, and then
right.
When you have to, you have to. So it's a sort of a best of both worlds situation. And again, these are not low, these are not high wattage bulbs. These are, you know, like a 60 watt bulb or something like that. And in this is one case, only time you'll hear me say this is one case where a regular incandescent bulb is probably the best choice, because you're really looking for the heat. So, you know, an incandescent bulb is probably the most finely manufactured heat waster you can think of. So as far as little things like that. So a compact fluorescent doesn't give off enough heat, and a LED certainly doesn't give off enough heat. So just a conventional, you know, Edison-style incandescent light bulb is about perfect, you know, 60 watts, 75 watts, something like that, depending on the size.
I have a question for you while you're saying that, because I've done this before where I had to stop dehydrating one day because a storm came up. Are you saying that it hurts the nutritional value if I would just kind of take it inside and hold it overnight and then put it back out?
No, it doesn't hurt the nutritional value. What it does is that you're at risk of not driving the moisture off in that period.
And mold setting in, huh?
Yeah, so the mold can set in. And now the other option there is to take your oven. Now this is a good test. You can, and I've done this. You set your oven, see how low your oven will go. And some ovens don't go low enough. That's I don't know if they just didn't think of it, or if they didn't want it to be used that way. But if your oven will set at warm and will stay at warm at 100 degrees, 110 degrees, or something like that, then that's a very good option. You can put your racks in the oven at that level. You could even if you didn't have an oven that went quite that low, you could possibly prop open the door and let some of the heat escape. You would need a thermometer. You'd need an oven thermometer to see it. I would never rely on especially at the fringes. You know, when an oven thermometer gets, when the internal oven thermometer in the oven itself, or the one that's built into the display, when that gets down to the very fringes of its range, you know, the very very low end and the very very high end, they get a little inactive. They're made more to be in the middle. So so I would buy a, you know, reasonably good kind of dial thermometer or digital one if they make them for that heat, just to stick in there to see what your actual rack temperatures are when the door's closed. And if you're getting at the 100 degree, 105, 110 degree level, then you can take it out of the rainstorm. I mean, it never should be in the rain, you know, rain on. But I mean,
right.
Humidity situation, you can just pop them on racks into the oven and rotate them if you have to. I mean, you know, let them spend a little time and then pull them out and set them on another rack in the kitchen and then put your next batch in there. If you had like 5 or 6 or 8 trays, you may have to rotate them, but that'll take care of it too. You know, the whole point is just not to let the moisture reside or fester or whatever on the fruit or the herbs overnight or over a long period of time, because it will possibly create a mold situation. That's really the main concern.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you for clarifying that. That's excellent.
Yeah. It's really common sense. I mean, and you know, we talk about the homemade dryers and all that. Now, you can get pretty successful by just setting up a pair of sawhorses or a stand of some type, a clothes
That's
dryer.
That's what
you know,
I use.
The old-fashioned, the clothes dryers that you sort of unfold. And they have ribs. They stand up with the legs on them and stuff. You could even use one of those. Just some window screens and some sawhorses and the sun. I mean, we'll do a great job because you're getting air come from underneath. You're getting a sun come from the top. And what you don't want to do is let them sit in the direct sunlight.
Right.
You can cover them with parchment paper or some people use gauze. Some type of like cheesecloth, like that sort of tends to stick to the food, but paper's better. But you just need to cover it so direct sunlight does not get onto it, because it will overheat it. It will drive off the nutrients. So let's say we're using parchment paper. You can tear off big sheets and clip it to the window screen and just let the air get in and around there and let the heat beat down from the top. And it'll do it in a day or less, depending on your
on
the thickness of your stuff. And the only caveat there, and that, and also if you're homemade dryers, I would be careful as to what kind of screen you use. You may not want to use you wouldn't want to use galvanized window screen or materials that you might question as to whether they're when they're heated in the sun, if they really aren't passing plastic or toxins into your food. So the best bets there are. Fiberglass, which isn't really wouldn't be as bad as a propylene type window screen. Bronze screen, sort of expensive, but bronze screen would be fine. Just really anything that's not galvanized or potentially hazardous when it gets hot, and so you could be a little careful with that, because it's not really feasible to lay something down underneath that. Possibly gauze if the air can get through, but you need to have that air circulation from the bottom, and you need to have it protected from the direct sunlight on the top. So, and then if you were doing stacking them, if you were setting up racks and then maybe putting a little 2x4 between that rack and the one above it and the one above it, you can do it 2 or 3 or 4 tier racks even. I would just make sure that you were getting the air circulation and that you weren't letting the sunlight hit the top rack. You just cover that up. So,
right.
Richard,
just as for a poultry note on this, using the screens to air dry, that's how I dehydrate my comfrey. In fact, I'm going to do it this weekend, but it's a wonderful way. And then I'll keep it as fodder and greens for the winter. I just put it in a feed bag. But I've got screens, and then I just use 2x4s on end. So the long side is up, and put the screens and keep stacking them up on my picnic table.
Oh yeah, that's it works
beautifully as long as the storm doesn't come up. But comfrey is a wonderful dehydrated crop that is so easy to grow in your yard for your flock, and it's even sometimes 20% and more protein. So it's a really high nutritionally value feed for your flock. So I had to throw that in there since you were talking about screens.
Yeah, screen and chickens and some kind of supplemental stuff. Yeah, it's true. The thinner leafed herbs, catnip, savory, basil, dill, lemongrass, any of the common herbs that you get at the store, they're fairly thin leafed, meaning they're already have a fairly low moisture content. They can dry in a matter of 6 hours in a good you know, a good day, on a good day. If you get them out there early and they can really, you know, you get a temperature up at the upper end of that 115 degree point, and a good 6 to 8 hours will take care of that. When you start peeling, you start cutting up apricots and apples and such like that, you've got much higher moisture content in your food, even if it's sliced thin. So it's going to take longer than that. And that's, you know, that's really where the electric ones come in. You know, come in, they're just convenient. They come in very handy because you can, they have, most of them have timers, so you can set it for 16 hours or 20 hours, or some of them actually sense the, you know, they sense the moisture, so you know, it just won't over dry them. It'll shut off, you know, in time. So, you know, that's the way to go if you really want to do a convenient job. But you know, putting one together, basically just a frame of wood, with some kind of ledgers, what we call ledgers, I guess, in building, but they'd just be like rack holders, just strips of wood that would hold the racks, and enough to stack, you know, five, six racks in there, and you know, the size. I mean, some of the bigger ones can really measure. I mean, I've seen one from the Appalachian State University Applied Technology Department there. They had done a number of them. These guys were probably 8 feet, 6 to 8 feet long, and maybe 4 feet wide, and up to your chin, if not higher, with excellent, or even higher than your chin, really, with excellent ventilation, solar ventilation capability, and good internal ventilation, and you know, temperature control, and all that. And they have built pretty big ones, and then they've downscaled them as well, just to make them a little more convenient. But you know, you can get them pretty big, and you can get them much smaller. I have seen designs for you know, Girl Scouts and Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, just training in solar energy merit badges and things like that. And some of these are made out of cardboard and very thin wood stuff, and you know, about the size of a microwave maybe. And you know, perfectly good learning tool, a teaching tool, and a learning experience. And you know, when the drying procedure is different in within the box than it would be outside the box if you put it on the sawhorses, and you know, essentially you just really do not want to you just don't want the sun to beat directly down on the racks if you're sticking them out in the sun. In fact, it's so strong, the sun is so potent that in with those thinner herbs, you really may not even want to be drying them at high noon. I mean, you may want to. You start in the morning and pull it, you know, pull it about 11:30, and then put it back out at 1, just to avoid that really hot part of the day, because you know, that could be detrimental. You know, the key thing there is to make sure the herbs are completely dry before you store them, or else they'll contain their moisture. And the other thing is that you want to label the trays, because you know what they are going in as far as what they look like, but when they're dry, they all look the same.
It's true.
Yeah.
You have to taste them to figure out what it is.
Yeah, it's exactly. They're just shriveled up, you know, when the leaves curl and they get smaller, and they all sort of look the same color, and, you know, you really don't know what all it is. So it's just better to pick a piece of tape and, you know, just stick it on the screen. So one's, you know, one's rosemary, the other one's comfrey, wherever it might be. So, that's a good pointer, and the other thing is that in the dryers, when you actually have a box dryer, whether it's homemade or not, you really don't want sheets of paper in there. There are some special drying sheets that you can buy when the circulation is sort of managed, but in some of the homemade dryers, you really just don't want to lay a sheet of paper down there. Thinking you're making it cleaner or something, because that really does restrict the flow of air from the bottom, and you really need that flow. And the other thing is, in a homemade dryer, you may not have equal flow. The top rack may be a better position than the bottom. So what you'll need to do is, throughout the day, you may need to rotate a couple times a day. You know, put the top ones in the middle and put the middle ones in the bottom, and you know, rotate them around so that each one gets the opportunity to have the best spot, at least for a portion of the day, for, you know, solar drying. And you know, it's just a matter of experimentation. It really is. There's no one dryer. I mean, we're not talking about any one particular store-bought dryer. There's a couple of brands out there, and you know, all of them are different from the others in the store-bought brands. And then when you start talking about your own homemade ones, I mean, you've got a lot of variation there. So there was one nice little unit years ago. I remember that we had built on a couple called I think the name was Leandre Poisson. I think it's from Vermont, and he had taken a 55-gallon drum, painted it black, and then cut the trays. He set little flanges on the inside of the drum, bolted them in there to hold the trays. And then he slipped the trays in from the end and wrapped the whole thing in a flexible PVC type of sheet, like a greenhouse cover, greenhouse glass, you know, flexible.
Mm-hmm.
And left about an inch or so between the greenhouse cover and the black barrel, and that thing, you know, with the proper ventilation,
now,
if it wasn't ventilated properly, it would way overheat, but he had it managed, and very inexpensive, very, very functional, you know, not too big, not too little. I mean, it was, you know, not too heavy either. I mean, it was very reasonable design, so, you know, I remember using that for testing drying times of things, and it worked out, you know, very, very good resource. I don't know if you can even still find that. He didn't have a website then because we didn't have the internet then, you might want to Google it. 55-gallon drum dehydrator. That would be what I'd say.
Wow. Well, listen, Richard, this has been really, really interesting. I always learn a lot from you, no matter what you're talking about. But I've got an appointment I need to get to that's pretty important. So, Whisper, at this point, if you'll please excuse me, I've got to exit stage left here. And I'll certainly miss you the rest of the show, but I'll be here for Friday, Fun Frisky Frolicking Fractured and Foul-Filled Friday tomorrow. And tomorrow's my bagel day, too, so maybe I'll even have a bagel. It just makes Friday like a holiday for me. I'm so easy to please. Okay. Well, gentlemen, I know you're more in great hands and certainly will miss you. And as always and forever, I'll sign off and say, may the flock be with you. God bless everybody, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Very good,
you,
Pat. Thank you. Thanks for joining us today, Pat, and be safe later today if you have to hit the roads. And with that, we are going to take a commercial break. When we come back, we'll have about 15 more minutes talking about dehydrators and the process of. So stay with us, folks. We'll be back after this short break. We're talking with Richard Freudenberger, publisher and technical writer with Back Home Magazine. You can visit them online at backhomemagazine.com.
Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, pens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com. Or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing.
It's easy and rewarding to keep backyard chickens, and My Pet Chicken can supply everything you need to get started, including baby chicks, chicken coops, accessories, books, and free how-to information, plus fun gifts and rooster decor. At My Pet Chicken, you can buy as few as 3 baby chicks. They also sell fertile hatching eggs. Visit them online at mypetchicken.com. That's mypetchicken.com.
You've ordered your new baby chicks and even have the brooder prepared, but now it's time to order that new chicken coop. My Amish Goods offers quality-built chicken coops for every size, flock, and budget. They have many styles and colors to choose from and will ship them fully assembled right to your front door. Act now and receive a special upgrade at no additional charge. Visit them online at myamishgoods.com. That's myamishgoods.com.
Mount Healthy Hatcheries has been a hatching tradition for over 80 years. Home of the healthiest chicks, Mount Healthy Hatcheries offers a wide selection of bantams, turkeys, guineas, ducks, pheasants, and of course, meat birds and layers. Order online at mounthealthy.com. That's mthealthy.com, or give them a call at 1-800-451-5603. Don't forget to ask about their free bonus chicks offer. Mount Healthy Hatcheries, home of the healthiest chicks.
If you have experienced the disappointment of broken or weak eggshells, try MannaPro's Oyster Shell. Adding oyster shell to your flock's feeding program helps provide the calcium they need for strong eggshells. So don't let those beautiful eggs go to waste. Try MannaPro's Oyster Shell for your pullets and layers.
Hey ladies, do you have a hard time finding the perfect gift for that animal lover on your list? I did, but not anymore. I shop at HobbyHillFarm.com. They have a great selection of dog, cat, horse, and chicken gifts that are not only cute, but affordable too. Check them out at HobbyHillFarm.com and become a Facebook fan at Facebook.com/HobbyHillFarm to receive updates on new products and special discounts. I just know you're going to love HobbyHillFarm.com. I do. Established in 1957, GQF has become the name to trust when it comes to quality products and superior customer service. GQF offers a wide range of poultry products, including incubators, brooders, feeders, waters, and much, much more. Give them a call at 912-236-0651 or visit them online at GQFradio.com. That's GQFradio.com.
First State Vet Supply is your one-stop shop to keep your birds healthy and happy. They have a wide selection of medications, vaccines, vitamins, wormers, and much more. Every product comes with specific directions and doses for your small backyard flock. Have questions about a sick or injured chicken? Take advantage of First State Vet Supply's Ask the Chicken Doctor program. For just $25, you can have a personal phone consultation with Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor. The consultation fee is waived if you purchase a product from First State Vet Supply. Visit them online at firststatevetsupply.com. That's firststatevetsupply.com.
Actually, in reality, I am Super Chicken.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. It looks like we have about 12 minutes left, and today again, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine, and pardon me, we're talking all about dehydrators and the process of and the ins and outs and how to make your own and the good and the bad and the ugly. So welcome back, Richard.
Oh, glad to be back.
I do.
All set here. I did have someone here asked me a question.
Okay, great.
And I want to be sure I left it clear. We talked about, you know, using a solid dehydrator. We talked about if a storm came up or if the humidity got extremely, wet towards the end of the drying day, that you would maybe continue the drying in a very very low temperature oven or setting the food or the herbs out on a rack somewhere out of the rain or out of the humidity in a drier, less humid place to keep the mold from building in.
Uh-huh.
But the question was really, I guess I didn't make clear, the foods that take longer to dry, as long as there's not a humidity situation towards the end of the drying cycle, like if you had fruit leather or some type of a higher humidity, higher moisture food you were drying, and it was like a 2-day dry or even 2.5-day dry, it's perfectly okay to with a properly designed solar de- dehydrator, it's perfectly okay to, towards the end of the day, to shut the vents off. You know, these have in and out vents. So air can come in one end and out the other, or come in the bottom and out the top, or whatever, however it's designed. If you had a good day and you know, you had sun and there was no real rain involved, what you would do is then shut the vents and keep the herbs or the food inside the dehydrator, mm-hmm. and bring it into a dry place where you wouldn't have any risk of you know, condensation in the morning, or you know, having it out in the air or anything like that. If some, on the bigger ones, just rolling it into the garage or rolling it under the into a breezeway or whatever, and the food will continue to dry on its own in the box, and then in the next day you can just continue the cycle for a full day of sunlight, and that's okay. It's okay as long as you haven't trapped moisture from outside in the unit and then lock it up all night, because that's going to drive the moisture in rather than let it escape. So that was just a little clarification.
Is there, and I've probably asked this question before when we've talked about this topic, but one of the issues, and we have a dehydrator here, and one of the biggest issues for me was, can you dehydrate your product too long? Because I'll look at it, and I don't – some of the things, it may have come with an instruction manual that says, you know, banana chips cut this thick, this long, or apple chips or whatever. And, of course, then you put grapes in there to turn to raisins, and it's dehydrating for, like, you know, 9 years. Because
yeah.
There's so much liquid in there. but I just, you know, I'm the type that I'm looking at the banana chips, or I'm looking at whatever it may be, and I'm like – I'm not sure, maybe, you know, maybe I'll give it another hour. Maybe I'll give it another 45 minutes just to make sure, especially if I'm going to put it in something that I'm going to store long term, just to make sure that it doesn't, you know, get that moisture back in it, or it's not quite done to where it's going to stay dehydrated. Is there any good trick to that?
I would say the trick is really just observation. You know, the herbs will tend to curl first, and that when they start to curl, you know that you're on the verge of drying, so you really, you know, you really want to start keeping a close eye on the, checking them much more frequently once the herbs start to curl themselves, you know, the leaves. But and then when it actually is dry and there's no real reason to worry about drying it any further, is when they actually crumble, and when you pick them up and just sort of, you know, pinch them and they actually fall into pieces, break into pieces, because if that's really the ultimate test. If whether it's an herb or anything else, if it cracks, crumbles, or breaks easily when you pick it up and just sort of squeeze it, it's probably, you know, dry enough. If it's rubbery, pliable, it feels like it's, you know, bendable, whatever, then it's probably not dry. So, you know, that's a pretty good indicator.
Now, once we feel like it's done and we take it out, is there some do's and don'ts on what to actually, and not we won't talk about long-term storage, but just keeping it on the counter or the refrigerator, or keeping it somewhere where, you know, it can be accessible to, say, the kids for snacks or for us for snacks. Is there a good and bad as far as storage? You know, you probably wouldn't want to keep it in this type of container. It may introduce moisture back to the product, and then you're right back where you started. Is there any type of preferable storage container, again, Ziploc bag or, you know, whatever, or some that may not be warranted for dehydrated product?
Well, yeah, I, the only thing I would say is to keep it in a container that's like the refrigerator is designed to. It's designed to actually remove moisture. That's really what a lot of people don't realize, that a refrigerator is. It does keep food cool, but its prime job is to remove moisture from the mm-hmm. box. I mean, that's mm-hmm. why it keeps it cool. So you know, if it's dry to begin with, that's a pretty safe place for it. But you really don't need to put most things in the refrigerator. You know, a screw top. Like what the herbs come in when you buy them from the store, the crushed herbs, something like that might be, you know, like a jar like that might be a good container. A plastic bag would be okay, but that also has the potential for, you know, retaining the moisture more so, but at least you can see it. In other words, if you put it in there and it starts to drip, you know, like get drippy and misty in there, then you know uh-huh. that you know that you're really, you cannot be storing it in the bag any longer, because you're just going to encourage mold and mildew in there, and the microorganisms will deteriorate the food very quickly. So that's almost a good test. I mean, you can almost stick it in a little baggie, a good Ziploc baggie, stick a portion of them in and see if they're, you know, see if they're, not so much for that one cooking time, but for an experiment to see, okay, I put these out in the sun, you know, broad sun daylight for 6 hours, and now I'm putting some in the bag to see if moisture comes off. And, you know, if it does, maybe you need to set them out for 8 hours instead of six, you know, that kind of thing. But I would say that the plastic bag probably, unless they're extremely dry already, is probably not the best choice, but something like a small peanut butter jar maybe, or even something with a, if you have a dry environment in the home, which might be an air-conditioned house or something like that, it'd be okay to have it in where you have actually ventilation in the container. But once you have a humid, you know, humidity situation in the home, like, you know, I don't have air conditioning in my house, and we, you know, some days may be very humid in the house, and even with the fan going or something, and, you know, you probably don't want to leave the food in a container that will have access to the air in and around the counter, just because the kitchen's, besides the ambient moisture, the humidity in the air, the kitchen is also a pretty humid place. So, you know, you're actually introducing more humidity into the mix by doing that. So, you know, you're better off with sort of a closed container that has a little bit of leeway. You know, you really don't need to pack tight.
Right. Someone was saying they would use canning jars occasionally to pack some stuff in. So now, again, you hear oftentimes people say, oh, well, I'll use my oven to dehydrate. Maybe a lot of times they'll use it to dehydrate deer jerky or beef jerky or turkey jerky, and they'll just, you know, they'll do whatever seasonings they're going to do on it, liquid smoke and Worcestershire and things like that, and then put it on a flat tray and set it in there. And you know, all this stuff that pops back into my brain, you know, I'll set it on, you know, 125, and I'll leave the oven actually door open one notch and just keep it on 125, and eventually however many hours later we have it. But I would just guess that that's probably, I'm sure it works, people do it all the time, you hear about it, but I'm guessing that your modern day dehydrators, tabletop dehydrators, would be much more efficient than running that big dinosaur of an oven.
Yeah, exactly. That's the prime reason why you may not want to use the oven, other than the temperature limitations on the oven. There's one thing I can say about that, though. If your oven did get down to, 110, 115, or if you were able to determine with a accurate thermometer inside of it that when you set it on 125 and left the door cracked open, it would still maintain 115. If you packed enough food in there to make it to sort of warrant the use of that big dinosaur of an oven, that might be at least approaching something acceptable, but it again you can't pack enough in there, because once you start really packing too much in there, it's not going to get dry. Not so much that the temperature is wrong, but it's just that the air circulation isn't adequate. If you pack it too tightly or too densely in there, it's just not going to dry properly. So that, between that and the fact that you're leaving the door open, so you're not making a sustainable heat source. You're just sending it, you know, creating it at the bottom of the oven and sending it right out the door. That's, you know, highly inefficient. So you're absolutely correct. The homemade electric ones, or the store bought electric ones, or especially the solar, a well designed solar heater with a light bulb backup is going to be the much more efficient method to do the drying, because you're not wasting any heat particularly.
I've never seen any, as a lead up to my next question for you, I've never seen, doesn't mean it doesn't exist, in either an instruction booklet or I guess even online, where, for example, you know, If like in the South, we like to cook the heck out of everything. So, you know, we cook our green beans till they're just about mushy, and they've got to, you know, and we cook, you know, the crock pot, they say, because you cook it so, things so long, it just eliminates all the nutrients of that food for the most part, versus, you know, flash cooking this, that, or the other. But I haven't seen anything that shows that as far as the nutrient content or benefit of whatever you're dehydrating, how much of that stays intact of whatever food, I guess, you're dehydrating. I can't imagine it losing much, because you're just, you know, again, taking that air out. You're not, you know, cooking it at high temperatures for a long time. Any research on that or comments?
I don't have any firm figures on it. I do know there are figures on that. And essentially the comment would be exactly what you said. When you're drying at the food doesn't really begin to cook, you know, actually cook, quote-unquote cook, till 120 degrees Fahrenheit and a little higher in some, you know, depending on the food. So anything below that, all you're doing is removing humidity from the product itself, or removing humidity from the air within the product. So you're actually maintaining, you know, probably almost every bit of nutrient that was in there to begin with. I mean, obviously, you're going to lose some just in having when you set some fruit out on the counter and it gets drier, you're losing nutrients to some degree, because your nutrients are highest from the moment of picking, like corn. You know, when you bite into an ear right off the cob, plucked right from your garden, it has much higher nutrients and it tastes much better right then and there. You store it a couple of days and you eat it later, and it's not quite the same. The same with drying foods. I mean, the higher the temperature, and the more you drive off, and the quicker you drive it off, the much higher opportunity you have to drive the nutrition off too. But I don't know what the exact percentage is. If you're losing, you know, you're losing only 10% or 15% or whatever. But I do know once you get over 115 or so, you're starting to get into the range where you're actually starting to cook it.
And then, versus just dehydrating it and getting
And that's where the difference is. When you cook it, you're losing nutrition. When you're dehydrating it, you're maintaining most of it. So, you know, that's essentially the bottom line. But I'm positive there are accurate university studies that will probably break it out, and some of the ag science schools or whatever will probably break it out into exactly which herbs and which fruits and whatever at what temperatures and how much they maintain. You know, there's quite a bit of information on that in general. I mean, I have tables from my ethanol work, you know, the fuel alcohol stuff, that, you know, just about every crop is probably, you know, well over 150 crops, and exactly what the protein level is, exactly what the starch content is, exactly what the sugar content is of all these crops. And this stuff was done in the 30s and 40s. I mean, by now we have a lot more information too. So I'm sure it's somewhere. It's just probably a matter of spending a few hours on the internet and just reading some of the university studies.
Excellent. Well, this is awesome information. It always is whenever you come on. When's the next issue coming out?
Well, we're just getting it back from the printer now, so it'll be distributed. They start shipping them from the printer from a central location, and then the newsstand people get theirs and the subscribers get theirs. Depending on where it comes from and who gets theirs first. I mean, I always thought that subscribers should just legitimately get theirs first, but that doesn't always work that way.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason for that is, I that's why I've learned to accept it, is that it's more fuel efficient and more effective to do it the way we do it, and the price, the cost of that economy is that occasionally they'll be in the newsstand before they may be in your hands as a subscriber. So I think it's a pretty good trade off. We're not, you know, they ship them from several locations, so the fuel efficiency, we don't have to ship them from one end of the country and
bring
them all the way across. You know, so that's how it works. So it'll be about really early June when they first start coming out.
Okay, excellent. And can you just tell us, you may not have it in front of you, a few of the topics that may be in this next coming issue?
There's some additional information on some yurt, not homemade yurts as much, but just sort of it's sort of a sustainable business. Actually,
uh-huh.
it's about a sustainable yurt business that was sort of profiled, and there was a solar off-grid, off-on-grid solar home. In other words, a feedback to the grid, pretty high-tech home. Not a huge home, but a high-tech home where the gentleman took advantage of all the tax credits, state and federal, he could, and he got to the point where he could never have afforded the system he had, but he took a good look at the tax credits and the rebates and all that, and decided he couldn't not afford to do it. So he's in great shape now because he's never going to have to pay a power bill again in his life, probably.
That's awesome.
You know, he's selling it back. And there's let me see what else. There's a few other summer related. There's actually a good one on a roof cooled air conditioning system. It does not use compressors. It does not use any of that electricity. It's a very brief spray mist of water, which again I wouldn't recommend this kind of thing like in the Southwest, but in areas where we are blessed to have enough water, just a minute amount of water for several times a day. It is not a big use of sprinklers, but a very very scientific study by an engineer. We did a story on his invention here, and he's actually cooling his home with water sprinklers, but he set them up with timers and recollected and reharvested the water too. That's not the drain water is recycled. So it's a very very interesting thing. It's also very well documented. So it's not like he just made it up. I mean, he's a scientist, and so it's interesting.
That's fascinating because, again, our little farmhouse built in 1900, of course, no air conditioning. No, I mean, nothing, absolutely nothing. And over the last 6 weeks, we've had four different companies come out and give us a price on a central heat and air unit. Some was a dual fuel, like a heat pump that when it gets – because we're in South Georgia, so if it happens to get so cold where the heat pump's not efficient, then it kicks in with the propane heater on the rare days that you might need that. But the numbers we got were astronomical. You know, just thinking, not being in the industry, we thought, yeah, 6,500, 7,500, because the house is not that big at all. And they were coming in $9,000 to $12,000 for a central heat and air system, and I just about collapsed when I saw all of them come in like that. And I said, well, time to rethink. And so, you know, it's been a part-time residence for several years now. It's going to be our full-time. So over the years, we had, you know, the occasional windy unit. We got two real small windy units that were affordable, and then we popped for a big 12,000 BTU. But they're just so loud. And then the second issue is that Jen hates them hanging out of the windows. She thinks they look so ugly. So I've been shopping around at some of those freestanding. They still need to be vented, but they just have like I don't know, what is it, a 6-inch round kind of hose, like a dryer vent hose that comes and kind of goes out the window. The window only needs to be open about 4 to 6 inches. It vents out that way. Apparently it transmits the water collection so you don't have to empty the pan all the time. And those things are about $350 to $550, and I'm not really sold on them from a noise issue because it may not be doing anything different than what we have, just a different design. For those, I've done research on swamp coolers and what can we do to keep this house cool without investing $12,000. Come on.
Well, you know, you're right. And the swamp cooler, your humidity is probably too high for a swamp cooler to work effectively. It really needs to be a desert. This is not going to cure the upfront money problem, but you may want to look at it. It probably does not cost money to have a guy look at it, but geothermal or ground source heat pumps, same thing. You've heard of those, you know, the ground source heat pump. It is not cheap, but there are both federal and state tax credits for them. They're extremely efficient, but, you know, again, they're expensive to start with. But once they're in, there's no fuel. It's just the electricity for the compressor. They don't need fuel. I mean, there doesn't need to be a backup. I mean, they usually just take care of it from the earth. I could never explain it on the show in the amount of time we have because it's a a mystery of physics, but it does really work, and it works better in some climates than others. But you know, if you could find enough rebates and enough monies and tax credits and all that in the various pots of money that are laying around, you may be able to find something at least reasonably priced.
Better.
The problem is that most people there's not a whole lot of installers that are well versed in. You know, it's a new technology, so they're not really all over the place yet.
I found that with when we were looking at solar hot water heaters, I couldn't find anybody that would actually come out with a kit that would actually install that for me. And it's like, well, darn. So it's just time thing. So, well, thank you very much for joining us. We've got about 55 seconds left. Always a great show, great information that we can all use, whether it's for snacks for the kids, snacks for ourselves, long-term storage, making your own, in any budget. We talked about today with Dehydrating Foods with Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine. You love the show. You'll absolutely love the magazine, backhomemagazine.com, and you can subscribe there. Richard, thank you very much for joining us again today. We'll see you back in a couple of weeks.
Okay, we'll speak to you in June.
Great, thank you so much. Bye-bye. All righty, great show today, folks. Thank you very much. Thanks to Pat, who had to leave early, but we'll be back tomorrow with our Fun Friday episode, including giving away the grand prize package for a lucky school out there with our Chicken Coops for Classrooms contest. Have a great day, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow at noon.
Ha 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 ha